My name is Christopher Jansma, and my novel is called Our Narrow Hiding Places.
Christopher Jansma's new novel was inspired by members of his own family who experienced the Dutch Hunger Winter, a period during World War II resulting in famine throughout the German-occupied Netherlands. The book is titled Our Narrow Hiding Places, and it explores the hardships and lasting effects of generational trauma. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Christopher Jansma. So could you start off by giving our listeners a description of this book?
This book is about a family that is exploring its past to try to kind of uncover intergenerational traumas and secrets. The main character, Mika, is 81 years old when the novel starts. And after a sort of a slip and fall accident, her grandson, Will, comes to visit her in New Jersey in her house where she lives alone to look after her. And as the sort of the week they spend together goes by, he starts to learn more and more about her past. She survived when she was 8 or 9 years old, something that is known in Holland as the Hunger Winter. It was the final 6 months or so of World War II, when the Nazis that were occupying Holland at the time were sort of, they were losing, and the Allies were coming to liberate Holland, and sort of in the meantime decided to cut off all heat, electricity, and importantly, food to most of Western Holland, including The Hague, where Mika was growing up. And so the novel gets into sort of her, you know, horrible memories of that time and what she had to do to survive. And then learning about all that hopefully kind of helps Will to understand a little bit more about where he comes from and what he's capable of.
So where did this novel begin for you?
In March of 2020, as the COVID lockdowns began, and my grandmother was living alone at the time in sort of central New Jersey, I was sort of physically, geographically closest to her, although I was still several hours from where she lives. And so I was calling her every week just to check in and see if she was okay and make sure she had food and all these other things. And eventually ended up sort of driving down to deliver, you know, food and sending her some you know, PPE and things like that. And as we talked each week on the phone, we were talking a lot about everything that was going on and how uncertain it was. And, you know, this big fear at the time that things might get quite a lot worse, you know, very quickly. She knew several people that died from COVID early on in those early weeks. And it was all bringing back these memories for her of her childhood during the war. I, at the time, my son was 8 years old, had just come home from first grade, and, you know, we're now doing Zoom first grade. And I was very worried about what impact that would have on him socially, and, you know, if this was traumatic for him in some way, or if he would even remember it. Maybe, you know, maybe he would never remember any of it. And so I asked her about that, and she said, oh, no, he'll remember, because let me tell you, I have all these memories myself from that age. And that's really when she started telling me the stories about what she'd been through in the war. And as we talked kind of week after week, I thought, you know, I don't have time to sit and write a novel right now, but I'll get my notebook out and I'll start jotting some of these things down, because at some point I'll want to come back to this material.
So you mention Mika and Rob in your acknowledgments. Are they who served as inspiration for these characters?
Yeah. So I do want to stress the book is a novel. It is fiction, but it's probably the, you know, in some ways, one of the more autobiographical works of fiction I've written. I myself am very different from Will, and there's some other big differences in the family. But the character of Mika in the novel is based very closely on my real life grandmother. I call her Oma, which is just Dutch for grandmother, and real stories that she's told me about her own childhood during the end of the war. And her brother growing up, her brother is also named Rob. I have an uncle, Rob. And my grandfather, who she ended up marrying later, was also named Rob. And so there's a lot of Robs in the book. So Rob and Mika, both Robs and Mika are based on, you know, my actual grandparents and my great uncle. And I started writing the book after talking with her about some of those memories. And we started to talk a lot about what she'd been through and how she survived. And as I learned more about it, the more I felt like it was just sort of a novel that I had to write. And many of the things in the book then are based on her real life. The apartment building in the novel that she and her family live in is as close as I could get it to what she described to me. And many of the things that they go through there are based on her own experiences. And there are other things that I sort of added in that are fictionalized, but they're all based on true survivor accounts that I read in various other parts of my research. So everything that happens in the 1944, 1945 parts of the book are based on either her real experiences or similar experiences had by other people in The Hague at the time.
I was going to ask, when you write fiction that stems from real people and places and events, where does their story end and your artistic license begin? So is it with the more modern day stories that are all yours?
The modern day story was really much more purely fictionalized. I there are writers who love to write about themselves. I think, that start off, from a very strong kind of autofictional place. I've never really been that way. My first novel, it was all about a writer who lies to everybody about who he is. And I still feel that way most of the time. I think my life is pretty interesting, but, I don't necessarily want to be a writer who shares every secret little detail of my life. And I also want to be able to, in some ways, protect people around me, people in my family from that as well. So what I like to do a lot is sort of take inspiration from people that I'm close with, friends, family members, things like that. And then that's sort of why I'm a fiction writer and not a nonfiction writer at the end of the day. So I'll start with things that really did happen, and then I'll sort of let my imagination carry the story forward. And the decisions change a lot. I knew that I wanted part of my goal with this novel was to share the real story of what had happened to my grandmother, which is very important to her and also became very important to me. So I knew I wanted to keep very close to the truth in those sections. But there were things that, even in her story that didn't quite fit into a novel, and so therefore kind of needed to be changed. Just details about, the experience that her family went through that just would have been kind of like messy in the sense of a novel. In real life, her family sent her and her brother away to live with strangers in sort of a rural part of the country for a while in the middle of the war, and then they came back, unfortunately, right before things got really bad at the end of the war. And that could have been a fascinating novel all unto itself. What's it like at 8 years old, and her brother would have been 3 or 4 to, go off and live with strangers somewhere. But it didn't need to be in this book, right? So I kept everybody in The Hague in the novel, and instead of building that in to make it, it just would have made everything a lot more complicated.
So we have to talk about the eels. Eels are everywhere, appearing in both, past and present stories. There are sections of the book told from the eel's perspective, and now this perspective was a tool for the professor to write from within a Nazi camp. But these sections felt like almost like an interstitial chorus of sorts. Talk to me about the importance of the eels and also about using them to tell part of the story.
I wanted the book to explore Dutch culture, which was something that I grew up largely unaware of. Will makes a joke about this at one point in the book, but it's not a culture that we have a lot of stereotypes around, at least here in America. Nobody assumes anything about me because I'm Dutch, right? Unlike a lot of other places. And so it just never really was a big part of my life growing up. But as I worked on this book, I really wanted to explore that more. And one way I decided to get into it was through the folk tales that were sort of native to Holland, the ones that were very popular sort of prior to, I think, eventually, the Brothers Grimm came in and kind of took over. But so I found an old book of Dutch folk tales, and I started sort of exploring those and weaving some of those into the story in different ways. And I had these little sections of the book that I knew were going to kind of happen in the distant past or at different places in the timeline before Mika was born. And I started writing those out just as kind of little folk tales. And then somewhere along the way, I stumbled onto this scene. It comes fairly early in the novel, so this won't spoil anything, but a scene where Mika and her uncle go fishing for eels, and she, goes out and she wants to catch an eel, and she watches him catch it, and she watches him flay it and prepare it for dinner. And I had written that scene, and it was so, sort of exciting. And then suddenly I realized, I had this voice in the folk tales, and I wondered if I could connect those things together. So the eels become this sort of Greek chorus almost, who sort of jump into the narrative periodically. And I wanted the book to talk a lot about what we inherit from our ancestors, and also sort of how we understand ourselves in the context of a bigger history. And sometimes that's a national history that becomes sort of a culture. But I wanted some way to zoom out, basically, such that there was someone who could tell the story from, you know, going farther back than Mika or Will would be able to know. And when I was researching about the eels, one of the sort of fun facts I discovered was that we know they live a long time, but nobody knows exactly how long the natural lifespan of an eel is. And people think they may live for, you know, 80 to 100 years, you know, undisturbed. And I thought, okay, that's perfect, because then I can have these eels that, who knows, maybe they've been swimming around out here for a few hundred years and they've been able to, you know, see things as far back as, you know, Holland was once part of the Roman Empire and then it was part of the French Empire. And so I wanted some way to kind of see those bigger parts of the history.
You know, one thing that struck me as I was reading this, I started thinking about names, because we begin with Napoleon demanding that all families in the Low Country, they must choose a last name. But then these names would often change, you know, during immigration. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the importance of names.
My name is Jansma. In Holland, I'd be Jansma. Here, everyone says Jansma, which is fine. And that would literally translate to something like son of Jan. And it's just a, you know, kind of a normal patronymic kind of last name. This was another way that I started to explore sort of, you know, some of the Dutch history. I started reading, funnily enough, in the beginning, I started reading about Dutch celebrities at one point and thinking about, you know, kind of where their stories were. And I was growing up a big fan of Dawson's Creek, and the actor James Van Der Beek is Dutch, or his family must have been Dutch at some point. And his last name literally translates to from the brook, right? Or Van Der Beek. And so, yeah, so I started playing around with that. There's sort of this legend, and it actually may not be true, I've discovered, but the story goes that there are, you know, people in Holland whose last name is Nachtgeboren, which translates to born naked. And the legend is that it goes back to the beginning of using these names in Holland after Napoleon dictated that everyone had to adopt a last name, and that anyone who refused to pick a name was given the name Nachtgeboren as sort of like a punishment. And now that has been passed down, you know, through the generations. I've since read that this may not be true, but this was this is how it was told to me by my grandmother. And I just love that idea, and it fits so well with what I was writing here, which was this idea of a character in this case who doesn't want to have a name, who doesn't want to be responsible for passing it down to his children and having them be stuck with that same name going forward. And so he sort of stoically refuses to choose a name and is then given the name Nachtgeboren. And that name is now the family name of Mika's family in the novel. But when they come over to America, the name is sort of altered, and they become just the Geborns, because it sounds a little slightly more Americanized. And so Will is Will Geboren, and doesn't, I think, even really fully know, you know, how his grandmother went from being a Nachtgeboren to a Geborn here. And so this is, you know, one of the things he's going to discover over the course of his time with her.
Okay, there was a chapter titled Gripgearin, which I believe is Dutch for gripping. And it's a longish chapter about a search for food, and you don't even realize how long it is until you get to the end. And I just remember being palpably wrought, realizing that they had to do the same thing again tomorrow. And it was just this day-long struggle to get food. And that wasn't even the most haunting chapter in the book. You mentioned it a little bit ago. It was the hunger winter. So me as a reader feeling this wrought after reading this, what kind of effect did this have on you as a writer?
Those were tough chapters to write. I sort of wrote the Hunger Winter section last. In many ways, I had the most research, you know, behind that chapter, because that's the part that the most people have written about before. And I had survivor accounts mostly focused on those final 5 or 6 months and how kind of just truly awful things got. Just to give, you know, listeners some context, at the beginning of the Hunger Winter in maybe like October of 1944, The people in this part of Holland were already on rations of food. Your ration coupons would get you, I believe it was something like 750 calories a day, right? So, do the math. That's, barely one regular meal for most of us, right, through the day. And then through the course of the worst part, it was lowered down to something closer to, I think, 300 or 350 calories a day. I think I looked it up at some point. I think that's like a baked potato a day, basically that you're trying to survive on. And ultimately about 20,000 people starved to death in that part of Holland in those months from famine. Plus, beyond that, it was brutally cold. There was no way to warm anything. People burned everything that they had for heat. My grandmother was describing, as well, the V2 rockets were launching from only about a quarter mile, half a mile away on the beaches. And so the shock waves from the rocket blasts would come through the city and they would shatter the windows. So you couldn't leave your windows closed because then they would shatter and then you'd have no window left. But you also, obviously for wanting to keep the heat in, wanting to keep the windows closed for insulation. So it was just a terrible time and people, starved to death, froze to death. In some ways, that chapter, once I finally got to it, I had so much material that I knew it would come out fairly quickly. There was just so much to say. In Holland now, tourists come from all around the world to come see the tulips, bloom in the spring. When I was there researching in April of 2022 for this book, there were all these tourists in my hotel that were going out to take pictures in the tulip fields. And my grandmother still doesn't like to even look at tulips because during the Hunger Winter, they had to eat the tulip bulbs. You have to peel the core of it out. Otherwise, it'll make you sick. But otherwise, you can eat the bulb itself, and that was what they had to do to survive. So those sections were difficult. I kind of put them off until I kind of couldn't wait anymore to do it. The Gripjaren chapter was a little more fun to write in some ways because it's a little more of an adventure story. Mika and her brother. Basically, what happens, this won't give too much away, but the men in the building are forced to hide from the Nazis want to conscript all the men to go to work camps, and the men end up hiding. And so they're not able to then go out and sort of scrounge for food. So really, it was up to the children to go out and sort of hunt around for food to bring back for everybody. Mika and her brother have to do these, kind of in some senses, it felt like kind of fun, like almost like, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer kind of antics, right? They're robbing beets from the back of a moving vegetable truck and they're sneaking out into a wheat field to try to get some, wheat from a farmer without getting, shot over it, things like that. So that section was, fraught, but in some ways a lot of fun to write because it was, putting those characters in a little more of an active position. They're able to do something about it. And by the time we get to the Hunger Winter, there's really just nothing left. And it's really desperate at that point.
I'd like to talk about generational trauma because studies have shown a genetic component that is fascinating in that trauma can literally change one's DNA. While avoiding spoilers, can we talk about Will and how he inherits Mika's trauma?
Yeah. This was so one of the first things that I had always been interested in intergenerational trauma and the field of what's known as epigenetics, which is that study of how a traumatic event can affect your DNA, which then will be passed down to later generations. And particularly in the case of a traumatic event happening to a woman while she's pregnant. And then affecting, the gestating fetus, but also even later on, if something traumatic happens to someone, and then it can cause damage to the DNA that's then passed down as a mutation. So I'd been really interested in this a long time because so much of literature has always, to me, been about that, right? Everyone, people trying to kind of understand the past, the story of a family, and how these traumatic things are passed down from one generation to the next, right? I mean, it's the sins of the father kind of, narrative. I love the idea that there may actually be, after all this time, sort of, like a scientific underpinning to that, in some way. That we're now starting to understand. So anyway, in the novel, these things come up a little bit. When Will is meeting his grandmother, He and his wife have been trying to have a baby and it hasn't been going well. And the failure to have a successful pregnancy is really weighing on them. And it's starting to look like the two of them may end up splitting up just because this is something that they're having such a hard time with. And Will's very upset about it. At the same time, Will has not been fully honest with his wife about some of the things that he's been through in his past. And without giving too much away, he knows that he has inherited some things from his father, who went missing when he was young. But he has sort of learned over time more of the truth about what happened to his father, and that the father's struggles are, I think, directly connected in some ways to the trauma that happened to his mother, to Mika. And so a big part of the novel is about Will sort of tracing this all back and coming to understand the root causes, perhaps, of some of the things that he's been handed, and that he's now, you know, torn, I think, in some ways about passing along to a future generation himself, right? He's trying to decide on some level if he really wants to keep on pursuing having a family with his wife. I had all this sort of in mind as I started writing the book. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but one thing, things changed for me a lot as I wrote the book. As I got closer to the ending, I started to see that, yes, there is something to be said about the traumas that we inherit from previous generations. There's also something to be said about what happens when we keep things a secret from our children, and from when we keep the past a secret, they're not able to heal from that in the same way. But also in understanding what our relatives have been able to deal with in the past, as Will gets to know what Mika did when she was only 8 years old in order to survive, I think he becomes more keenly aware of what he has inside of him in terms of a resilience and an ability to survive difficult situations. In a way, I think understanding it becomes kind of a strength for him by the end of the novel.
I was struck a bit by the symbolism throughout. You know, at the end, some eels were described as a mound of question marks, and the supposed first name of the author of this book is literally translates into question mark. You know, perhaps the repetition of some artifacts, the trunk that we see on both sides of the Atlantic, or the gold letter opener that is used as a weapon during the war but brought to America after the war and is used for its intended purpose. Or there is an idea that is like bookended in this story, and it was the repetition of a man without a soul. And I don't know if I have exactly a question for this, but you mentioned a bit ago about having something in mind when you started the book. For things like like what I just described, do you have those in mind as you write the book? Are they plotted out, or is it just a gift? Go ahead.
I don't know if I'd call it a gift, but it's they are things that I discover along the way for the most part. A lot of times I'll have, you know, just sort of like a writerly feeling about something, right? You know, I'm thinking about as I'm writing an early scene in the book, oh, I know I want to incorporate this. For instance, there's a trunk that is very important to the family that I wanted to work in there somehow. My grandmother has a real trunk, a real carved trunk that I was obsessed with as a child and just wanted to put in there. And this is sort of the magic of writing fiction, and for me, which is that as the story develops and you start to see the deeper symbolic meanings inside of those things, right? And then even all of a sudden recognize, you know, plot potential in these things, right? Somebody, if you have a trunk in the story, someone can hide in that trunk, right? And you have to, as a writer, sort of solve these little puzzles, right? What does Mika keep in that trunk now that she's an 81-year-old woman, right? There's something that could significant could come into play there. So for me, that's the, you know, again, the hard part, but also the really fun part of writing fiction, which is you build yourself, you know, almost kind of like a little raft out of all these symbols, you know, and some of them may not go anywhere. Some of them may come out later in the editing process. But for me, finishing the book and then going through the revision process is in many ways about sort of figuring out, okay, where is there still sort of potential here in these symbols that I haven't explored enough yet, or I set something up and I haven't figured out how to pay it off quite yet. And that to me is really where it gets exciting as a writer, because I know as a reader That's the stuff I love the most, right? You love that moment, hopefully, as a reader, where you turn the page and you go, oh my God, that thing from, page 30, it's back, and now I understand. And I wish I could claim that, as a writer, you have this just sort of like genius super idea of the book right from the beginning and you saw it all coming. But I think the reality is, at least for me, and I think this is probably true for most writers, that yeah, that actually is, it comes out in the sort of the scaffolding of the book, right? You get excited discovering it in your own book, and you know that the reader will too once they get to it.
That actually happened to me when Will was sitting in the water with the seaweed around it, and I actually wrote, "Oh my gosh, that was her vision." And then the next paragraph was explaining that this was her vision. I'm like, "Oh." I thought I had discovered it.
Got it. You got it. Yeah.
Okay, so I mentioned earlier having to look up translations of some of the words. How familiar are you with the Dutch language?
I'm not very, unfortunately. My grandmother, my Oma, still speaks it. And when I was growing up, I would listen to her and my father speak it to each other. He was born in America. He was born in Chicago, but then they actually moved back to Holland when he was, I believe, in second grade. And he lived there for about a year. So he still has a fairly good, working fluency in Dutch now. Then they moved back to America again after that. And so, I've heard them speak it. I've picked up maybe a dozen words from that. And her mother in real life, my Oma's mother, I called Oma Holland growing up because she lived in The Hague. And we went to visit her several times when I was growing up. And I spent a week at her house by myself at one point. And she lived to be 104 years old. And we were all there for her 100th birthday. So because of her, I had occasion to go and visit Holland and spend time there a few weeks, every couple of years when I was a child. And so anyway, I have a little bit of a sense of the language, but a lot of it I had to pick up along the way. Which is tricky because, people in Holland, there's this, of course, the wonderful Dutch language. Every time I would go and meet people, I would be excited to talk to them and hear things in Dutch. They were usually so excited to practice their English with
Right.
me, because they all learn English, or many of them learn English at school, and so most of the time they were so excited to talk to me that I didn't really get to pick up very much.
As a young girl, Mika loved reading Sherlock Holmes, and she even compares aspects of her life to the stories. Are you a Sherlock Holmes fan, or did this come from your grandmother?
No, I don't think that came from her. I read them when I was a boy. I read a lot as a kid, and I loved those kinds of mystery stories. When I was growing up, when I was about Mika's age, one challenge with the book is that, of course, I didn't know my grandmother when she was 8 years old, and how could I? And she can tell me a little bit of what she remembers about it. But I had to kind of, really for large sections of the book, really tell the story from the point of view of an 8-year-old girl. And so I thought a lot about my son at the time that I was writing the book was about that age. So I looked to the things that he was interested in and tried to remember what I liked a lot at that age as well. And for me, it was more Encyclopedia Brown and The Great Brain, and there were different books for me chronologically, but they're all sort of newer versions of those Sherlock Holmes mysteries. I did once teach a class on detective fiction, which was really fun, and we did The Maltese Falcon and Raymond Chandler and some other novels like that. And in that class, I had the students read a lot of Sherlock Holmes stories so that they could kind of see, where it was coming from, where the sort of the detectives trope that they were building on was evolved from. Yeah.
Are there other literary texts that influenced the writing of this book?
There were a number of different things that I looked at different times. Fortunately for me, maybe, but it was hard in the writing process. There hasn't been a lot written about the Hunger Winter, certainly not in terms of fiction. I read, survivor accounts. I read some sort of more academic works about it and histories, but I didn't have a lot to go to in that sense for those. But little things, again, kind of like I said before, the way that these symbols take on meaning along the way, there's this wonderful thing that happens as you're writing a book over the course of, usually several years, where other things you read just suddenly feel like they resonate and take on meaning. One of those was actually a book about eels, and that was one of the things that helped me realize the potential of those eels in the book. The only other one, there were a few memoirs I read. I wanted to read some, again, kind of non-fictional accounts. It was a beautiful, very sad diary called, I think, At the Edge of the Abyss, that was a diary kept by a man named David Koker, I believe, who was eventually killed in the concentration camps in Germany, but lived for a while in the concentration camp in southern Holland that I was sort of basing part of the novel on. And so I read that memoir to try to get some feel of the detail of kind of daily life at the camp. Those were some things that I turned to. And then other things, I mean, this may be silly, I don't know, but I was reading The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay from a few years ago, which is just a fantastic book. And as I was reading that book, it was one of those things where I didn't think it had anything to do with what I was working on. And suddenly I'm getting about 100 pages into the book, and I realize, wait, she's also going back and forth from the past to the present, and she has these long sections set, earlier. And I literally went back and I looked at what she did, and I measured, I counted up how many pages does she spend in the past versus in the present? What's the balance between those sections? Because it felt just right to me, and I wanted to see, okay, how can I do that? So I want to make sure that the past feels like really the heart of the novel, but also that the present sections don't just feel like a frame around it, that there's a real weight to those as well. And so I took a close look at what Rebecca had done there, and just literally counted the pages and figured out sort of what the pattern was, and thought, okay, I'll go for something close to that, So again, it's kind of part of the fun of writing, I think. You just never know where those ideas are going to come from.
When we last spoke in 2016, you talked about how you like to break rules in your writing. Did you break any rules in this book?
That's a great question. I think so. I think, having eels narrate parts of the story in the first person plural is maybe not a rule, but it's a little odd in some sense. There, I think it can change a little bit with each project. One of the I think every book has sort of challenges behind it. One for me in this case was, again, I wanted to make sure that Miko is really the protagonist of the novel, and that even with Will there, knowing that Will is probably the character I relate to the closest, that he wasn't going to sort of steal the show, or it wasn't going to become all about him. So that became a little bit of a challenge in some ways in the book. I don't know if it's breaking a rule exactly, but writing a novel in which the sort of my students call this the self-insert character is first of all really not you at all, and second of all relegated to hopefully more of a secondary character status felt like a challenge in that way.
Well, you mentioned Will not taking over the book, and when we last spoke, you said you were working on writing from a woman's point of view. Was that in preparation for this book?
That may have been something else. I wrote between my last novel, which is Why We Came to the City, and this one, I worked on a couple of other projects, all of which I'm very proud of, but none of which were quite, ready to go. But writing from a woman's point of view is something that I've always, again, cross my fingers here, and hopefully the readers agree with me, but it's always something I've felt, a little more comfortable with than I know a lot of other writers do. It's something that I remember. One of the first short stories I ever wrote was from the point of view of sort of a young girl character. And I remember when I brought it into class, that was something that the teacher, Alice McDermott, was my professor back then, sort of complimented me on and said, hey, you actually pulled this off. That's something I see a lot. And I thought, okay, that's good to know. I can do that. So, yeah.
Wow, she was your professor. That's fantastic.
Yeah. In fact, she gave me a bit of advice that really helped with this, because when I was interviewing her for another project, and she asked what I was working on. I told her I was starting this book, and I said, I want to write it. It's based on sort of my grandmother's stories, but it's historical fiction, and I don't really, I've written mostly contemporary-ish, fiction before, and I'm a little worried. I don't know how to do it, and hadn't even really been thinking at the time that Alice writes a lot of, sort of stories set in the past, because I don't think of her as a historical fiction writer. And she sort of patted me in the back, through the phone and said, Chris, it's all just fiction, right? It doesn't matter. Don't think of it as something different than what you would normally do. And that really just helped a lot because it made me realize that there wasn't something, some secret different trick that I had to do in order to make it work, just because it was set in 1945. Yeah.
Do you have a hope for this book? What do you want readers to take away from it?
I think my first hope for the book really is just a personal one, which is, I wanted to write something that told people about what happened in Holland back then. I think, people need to know always what it's like to survive in those kinds of terrible circumstances. We see them playing out again in the present day all the time. And I think the more that the reader is able to understand, what that is like and what the impacts of it, the better. I also want people to, kind of understand that little corner of history that happens to connect to my life and my family's life, which I think has not necessarily been overlooked, but, hasn't really been written about as much as other parts of this war in particular. And then I think in the larger sense, I hope, beyond all that, I imagine those might be the kinds of things that bring a reader to the book in the first place. And my hope is that by the end of it, readers will be able to, sort of see in Will's progress through this, how when we understand better where we come from, the real truth about our families, that those can be very hard things to face, but that they ultimately can show us how strong we are and that we have a resilience that we may have underestimated before. And that's something positive that we can take from traumatic things in the past. It's something positive that we can see ourselves passing along to the future. Those are really the big things that I hope somebody is thinking about when they're finished with the book.
The novel is Our Narrow Hiding Places. Christopher Jansma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Christopher Jansma, author of the book, Our Narrow Hiding Places, which was published by Echo. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.